Hello, friends, and welcome to Backstory. I'm your host, Alex Roberts. My guest today is Karen Twelves, a writer, copy editor, and improv performer who's been hosting workshops on Improv for Gamers that teach improvisational performance and storytelling techniques that happen to work really well at the gaming table. Or in the general LARP area, if you want to get weird, which I usually do. She is now coalescing those workshops into a book, one full of hands-on practice games that you can play with your gaming group to unlock creativity and build new storytelling skills and generally kind of come out of your shell and be more confident. I don't know if any of y'all like games, but I read the book and I was very intrigued, so I had to have her on the show. Folks, before we jump into it, I just want to remind you that I will be at Big Bad Con again this year. It's one of my favorites and I never miss it. It's October 11th through the 14th in Walnut Creek, California. That's in, like, you know, the San Francisco Bay Area. And I'm going to be running with the help of Steve Sigetti, James D'Amato, and today's guest, 10 simultaneous, all-in-the-same-universe games of StarCrossed. We're calling it Space Station Phobalex. It's going to be a total riot. I will also have a prototype of my new game called For the Queen. It's on the schedule, but it's full up. But if you want to check it out, just come by and say hi. Seriously, never hesitate to say hi to me at cons. I love it. Anyway, Big Bad Con. See you there, hopefully. Then you try to do both at the same time. It's like, don't know. Don't know about that one.
It's tough. There's, you know, everything that I'm doing outside of my job, or rather that I'm not getting paid for. I'm in a fair amount of like staff organizations at work. And then all of my editing and improv and gaming is all things that I would like to have more time to put energy into. But I can't because I have to put time and energy into this other thing that's uninspiring so I can pay rent and like feed myself and, you know, own a dog and things.
Yeah, the three necessities.
Yeah, pretty much. So it's interesting, and I'm trying to think about how I can make money doing things that I want to do more, and I don't know.
So this is kind of funny because this is actually something that I had wanted to ask you about when I interviewed you for the Bully Pulpit Games website some time ago. You know, you talked about wanting to do this more on a full-time-ish basis and thinking about...
I did. And I haven't yet. I'm still in the same position. I just don't know. I don't know if copy editing full-time would really be pulling down the numbers that I need to still live in the Bay Area. It's prohibitively expensive here. And I'd like to keep staying here as long as I can because I like it. But, and I'm trying to think about too, like, are there ways that I could get more money teaching improv? And I feel like I need to just be more direct with some of the people that I know who own improv theaters and sometimes do corporate improv, of just saying, hello, I would like a job, please.
Yeah.
And see what happens. I've had some success being that direct with people.
It's hard to put yourself out there like that though, isn't it?
It is. It is. It's tough. And it's hard when you feel like you've got the skills to do something, but you don't have something on your resume to prove it. And, or you do, but it doesn't look the way that somebody would imagine it looking.
How has performing impacted the way that you kind of present yourself to people?
It's funny. I notice much more clearly now when I'm on versus when I'm off. And you know, not just from a stage thing, but yeah, like when I finish a show, I'll go up there and I'm performing a lot of short form right now, which is very exciting, but very challenging because it's constantly high energy. It's high energy all the time. And I do two 90-minute shows back to back. And so I finish and it's 11 o'clock at night, which is already way past my bedtime. And I just don't even want to talk to anybody. Which is great because I come home and Sean's like already going to bed. And I'm like, I'm just going to sit and look at my phone for 45 minutes in like perfect silence. And I notice that after any time that I'm, you know, that I'm teaching as well, I'll have a lot of nervous energy from being done and no longer being in this like happy, perky, performative space, which I really enjoy being in, but it's not maintainable. So once it's over, I have a lot of drop and I don't want to talk to anybody.
You know, you're not the first person to express that to me, that there's like a post-LARP drop or that post-con drop.
Yeah. I mean, it happens because you're just so excited. And I feel like when I'm performing, I love it. You know, once I'm up there, I love doing it. But you have so much adrenaline. And then when you're done, you just get tired.
Right. It's kind of unavoidable.
But like even today, I was at this workshop at work and they had all these parts where you could discuss things with your partners. And I find when I'm in a situation like that, where it's like, you know, chat with each other about whatever, I have plenty to say, perhaps too much. I actually have to make sure I don't do too much overlapping talking because I'm very much an overlapping talker. But then we finished and I thought maybe I would go grab lunch with people. But then I was like, actually, I don't think that I want to speak to anybody right now. And I went and got lunch and I saw a coworker that I hadn't seen in some time. And I was like, oh man, she'd be like really good to network with right now. And I was like, but I just don't even want to talk. So I kind of like pretended I didn't notice her.
Oh man, classic move.
Yeah, and just went about my day. And like, she didn't recognize me. I didn't say hi to her. So it worked out great.
So this is like improv for introverts.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's definitely a great way to get out of your shell. And it was when I started doing improv, which was like right at the start of 2008, I had moved back to Oakland for a little bit and all of my friends currently there had moved away. So I kind of felt like a stranger in my own town because I didn't know what to do with myself. And I started, you know, kind of getting a little bit more introverted and depressed. And a friend said, hey, do you want to come take this improv class? And I said, I guess, because I needed an excuse to get out of the house. And it was like a 4-class series. And then after that, I just signed up for classes at the theater and kept going. And I could get into shows there for free. So that was suddenly something that I was doing every Friday or Saturday night. And it was kind of just to get out of my apartment where I was going stir crazy. And I ended up making, you know, some really amazing friends that I'm still friends with now. So it was great. It was really fun.
I love that. I really love this thing that you feel really passionate about that is like on some level kind of against your nature in a good way.
It's something that I really enjoy doing in like measured portions. I feel like that, you know, that's the same with gaming as well. I love gaming and, you know, have big dramatic, you know, very intense games or, you know, lots of really funny stuff, but you get burnt out. You know, you can get kind of tired of it, and especially like the performative aspect of games.
I was actually wondering how gaming fit into that love of improv. I was wondering which came first.
Oh, well, I started gaming in high school when a friend asked me, hey, do you want to play Dungeons and Dragons? And I said, okay, and then loved it. And so that was all their fault for getting me started. So definitely gaming came first, and I went, I think, kind of a traditional path for the time where I started with D&D 2nd edition through high school, and then college discovered more World of Darkness stuff and was playing like mage. And, you know, we were too cool to actually play vampires, so we played all the other ones like fae and werewolf and the ghoul. Is it called ghoul? You were ghouls. Anyways, we played all of those. And then I went abroad and I started playing like more pulp action. And then I moved back to the States and I discovered Spirit of the Century and then just kind of fell right into a lot of narrative games. And yeah, because Endgame used to have a monthly game day. And I'd go there all the time. and just play whatever was on offer. So I got to play a lot of weird stuff, which was fun.
So Endgame is your friendly local game store. And if I'm right, that's actually where the Improv for Gamers workshop started.
It is. We used to do it as part improv workshop, and then we actually would have a game session for about 2 hours. So the very first Improv for Gamers was, I think, a two-hour workshop or so, and then 2 hours for Fiasco. And that actually, Improv for Gamers is how I met Jason and Steve from Bully Pulpit, because did I ever tell you that story? So I had this idea of, like, I need to teach gamers more improv. This needs to happen more because there's not enough of it. And improv is very expensive and it's extremely applicable to what we're doing because it's all storytelling skills and there should be more of it. And I think I was also recently frustrated with, like, somebody at a table, and I was just like, that's it. I need to teach more gamers how to do improv. And then I wanted to have, you know, the practice after immediately, like, and now we're going to play a game that lends itself to a lot of these skills. Fiasco is extremely improvisational, so it was a really good example game for that. And then I got it. We were charging money because at the time I was paying a friend of mine to do the kind of main facilitation, and I was co-facilitating. And I since then, you know, now I'm teaching it on my own. But, you know, 6 years ago, I didn't have as much teaching experience, so we had worked on developing the curriculum of it together. But I wanted to pay her for her work. So we charged monies and gave it all to her, which was great. And but then I was like, oh no, I'm charging money to run Fiasco. Is this going to be, like, a problem? And I kind of knew Jason. He knew another, we had a mutual friend, and somehow I was friends with him on Facebook. I don't know how, because I'd never met the guy. But I went to Gen Con that year for the first time. And I went with Sean, and I was talking to Sean all about Improv for Gamers, and we were planning it. And I had this horrible fear of, like, what if I get in trouble for charging for an event for playing someone else's game? I was like, I don't know if that's cool or not. And, you know, because people have different feelings about that. And we happened to be at this podcaster party at a bar, and Sean came over to me and he's like, Jason Morningstar is right over there. I was like, oh my God, oh my God. So we both freaked out and went over and introduced ourselves. And I gave this extremely breathless, rambling, far too long elevator pitch about running an improv workshop and then playing Fiasco after, and we're charging money for it, and is that okay? And it took forever. And Jason was very politely listening, like, and just, like, being, you know, really hard to read, as he is sometimes. And I said, like, so what do you think? And, you know, there was this long beat of me thinking, oh my God, he's going to say, like, no, I'm sorry, you can't use my game for that or something. And he said, that sounds cool. And if you can fly me out, I'll come. And Sean, and so we freaked out and was like, this is the best thing ever. So that's where more of the money then went to when we started, was covering for his flight. And then Steve Sagetti, so Jason then emailed me and he said, hey, so my friend Steve heard about it and he wants to come too. If you can also put him up, but you don't have to pay for his ticket. That's my bad Jason impersonation. And I just try to pitch my voice slightly deeper. And that's how I had, you know, the masterminds behind Bully Pulpit sleeping in my living room for 2 nights. And yeah, and we ran this workshop and then we played Fiasco, and then they did a whole, like, Fiasco mini convention at Endgame the next day, you know, since they were in town. And it was great. And we used to run Fiasco, and then we switched a little bit and started doing Archipelago, which is also a really great improvisational game. Then I started teaching it at conventions, and it wasn't necessary to have that part to it anymore because it was like, all right, now go forth and game at the things that you are already doing this weekend. The only tragedy is if I get scheduled later in the con. I always like to get in.
Right, so people can then apply and practice. Yeah.
Exactly, yeah.
So this series of workshops has coalesced magically into a book. And, you know, I've been going through it and it has this really specific structure that you're describing where, you know, I will introduce you to this concept and I will tell you about this idea. And, you know, maybe I will even quote some of the people who came up with some of these phrases or whatever, but now you have to do it. Now here's the exercise.
Yeah, and I realized, you know, at a certain point you have to stop writing, as I'm sure you understand, and I'm already thinking about, like, I don't know if I made my examples nerdy enough. Like, I could have gone, like, full gamer, and I held back a little bit. I was trying to be very diplomatic because there's so many styles of gaming and improv, and I didn't want this book to feel like it was telling you this is the right way to do it, but very much like, hey, there are overlapping skills. For example, active listening is very important. You know, as a gamer, you want to pay attention to what other people at the table are contributing. And you know, the whole yes and idea is, and then you want to take those ideas and work with them and, like, build something together. And you can practice those skills with this fun little group theater game. So I'm not necessarily telling people, like, you should get on stage and do improv. I actually really, in the workshops, we don't do too much that's very performing. A little bit at the end, but oftentimes we'll have people kind of do scene work more as a way to practice doing other things. Like, there's a whole exercise to allow people to practice cutting scenes and directing scenes, and but they have to have some scenes going for them to cut. And so I kind of tell those people on stage, like, don't even worry about being funny, about being interesting. Like, you're going to be funny and interesting anyways because you're a gamer, so you're a wonderful storyteller, like, by nature, but don't worry about it. Like, the person who's actually practicing right now is the director. I think in saying that, I try to really isolate the skill that each exercise is working on and try to focus on, like, don't worry about the rest of it. And it's the same thing I say when I teach straight improv for performers is, you know, we're in a practice space. So we're going to try out new stuff. We're going to make some mistakes. Maybe not everything's going to work, and we're going to stretch muscles individually.
Right, isolate. This is actually kind of a through line in the book, though, about what's that Keith Johnstone quote about, like, daring to be...
dare to be dull.
Yes, dare to be dull.
Yeah.
Yeah, this idea that, like, don't try or try, but... try to be mundane. I don't know. How would you express it?
Oh, man. I mean, I think that I think you could unwrap that in so many different ways. For me, it's don't try to be funny. And also, you don't have to be the most interesting thing in the room to be the most appreciated.
Okay. Tell me more about what that means.
So there's an exercise in there called tableau that I enjoy, and you physicalize objects in a room. That's it. That's the whole point of it. And it's you decide, like, what's the room going to be? You pick a room, like, maybe filled with stuff, like a garage. And everybody goes in and establishes that they are taking up the physical space of an item in that room. And you only need one, I think in the book I use the example, like, you only need one, like, femur in the fireplace. You only need one weird thing, and which is another kind of important improv-y rule, which ties into that. Like, it's okay to come in and be the oil stain on the garage floor because that belongs there. It's very satisfying when people bring in offers to a scene that just fit because it's what you were expecting. It fits in your imagination. We like patterns and, you know, we like being surprised, but we also like being reassured. And so when people come in with, like, that thing that you hadn't thought about, but once you see it, you're like, oh yes, that is the perfect garage thing. The old green army bag filled with old t-shirts that you use as rags. Like, one, that's great. And so when people come in and they bring in, like, the mundane, it's appreciated. It's, you know, you don't have to try to be the most interesting thing in this garage. The point isn't to be interesting. The point is to come together and kind of make this great picture of a garage. And even if we were doing something more genre specific, we want to do a space station, we don't all need to be, like, the weird flashy red light that means that, you know, something's going to explode soon. Like, having one weird element would be great, but everybody else should be kind of brave enough to step back and just be something that belongs there and makes sense. Does that make sense? I don't know. I don't know if that makes sense.
Yeah, yeah. And no, completely, completely. Because, you know, you talk about patterns and surprise, you know, and that's really the source of humor. But You literally can't be surprised until you have some expectations set up. Like, that's the nature of surprise.
My favorite type of comedy for improv and for gaming, and again, this is just my personal favorite, is people who take something very small extremely seriously, or they take something absurd very seriously. So the character is authentic and genuine and sincere. It's the situation that is bonkers. And for me, I love that dichotomy as opposed to the wackadoodle character not adjusting to the normal world. Like when it flips, for me, that's not quite as interesting. It gets a little old, but I love, and that's why I like my favorite, not to get back to Fiasco. It's funny because I haven't played it in a long time and now I'm thinking about it a lot again. My favorite setting for it is Nut People, which is about a small agricultural town during like the pecan trade. And so like there are so many relationships that you can have with each other as nut thieves. And, you know, they don't really, you're not making that much money off of stealing pecans, but the stakes are very high, even though the payout is really low. And so I love that game because people in classic Fiasco fashion are making horrible decisions for such small gains.
Yeah, I actually really, really love super mundane settings for that reason, because I think people are at their most illogical and for that reason, they're most relatable when the stakes are really low, like when there's nothing, when there's really not that much money to be made, or when there's really, you know, you're only going to come out of this so famous or whatever. People just fight like dogs in situations like that.
Yeah.
And I love it.
Yeah. I love those stories as well. So, yeah. So thinking about Dare to Be Dull, I like setting very kind of a mundane baseline to start with, rather than trying to have something a little too wacky to go with. Because then where do you go from there? Like, you can't ramp up if you already start at like a 9 or a 10.
And how do you modulate that kind of tone in an improvisational setting?
I don't want to present myself too much as like the expert on all things improv. In my experience with my troops, we'll have maybe one character who is the one weird character, or at least have one character who is the quote unquote straight man who responds to that weird character. And I think things, kind of the rising and falling action comes when somehow the relationship between those people changes. And so you might have scenes that build up in intensity, and they build and they build and they build until you find some revelation about your relationship with each other, or you discover like new stakes in the situation. And there's this kind of beat, you know, where you sit with that for a little while, and then maybe the intensity kind of settles back down. And so you can kind of play with ratcheting things up and then falling back down a bit. I don't know if that made a lot of sense.
No, I love that. I love the idea of playing with tone as a very fluid thing. I don't know how you feel about trying to establish tone really early on. That's a piece of advice that I see a lot, and I kind of struggle with it a bit because I don't know how practical it is.
So when you say establishing tone in an improv setting or in a gaming setting?
I mean, in a gaming setting.
I mean, I think tone is part of the buy-in for the game. It's important to set expectations. And that's also just like my personal flag that I will fly, is that there should always be clear expectations set, so that because you want everybody to be on the same page. It's why game descriptions are really important, so people know what they're getting into, you know, at a convention if you're signing up for something, or if you're just going to play a new game with your friends that they're not familiar with. You want to let them know, like, hey, we're going to play a game about X, Y, and Z, and kind of let them maybe compare it to other movies if there's a particular style that you think it's similar to, or let them know the type of tone that you're going for. I've absolutely been in games, horror games, particularly, where the GM has said, you know, this is a horror game, which means if you guys start getting a little too giggly or things get a little too silly, I am going to ask you to reset a little bit and bring that back down. and take that away from the table. And I hadn't really heard that before, but then it did happen because, you know, you can't help but then start having some side talk and making jokes. And the GM kind of said, hey, I just want to remind you guys, we're playing a horror game and I would like to keep the tone here tense for that. So, and it was a great game, and it required us to all understand at the beginning what type of story we were telling together.
Okay, that's very well said. I like that. I'm into that.
Yeah. I talk a lot about group buy-in in some of the exercises that I do in the workshops, and some of those are in the book too, about understanding the genre and, again, adding things that grow that genre as opposed to trying to put together a bunch of disparate things and making it work. Like, you can absolutely make it work if you've got a weird hodgepodge of characters, but it can be more difficult sometimes than having characters that all fit the theme.
Yes, I see what you mean. I can see so many unfortunate divergences.
I think in the book I use the example of something of, you know, if you're going to have a maybe gritty cowboy game, you might want to leave your winged were-tiger character concept at home. Not to say that couldn't work. Like, you could make that work, but it might be hard. It might not be what other people were expecting. And so then, again, there's this clash of expectations, and now people aren't happy because they thought that they were getting one thing, and now they're fighting to justify and incorporate this other thing. And there's a time and a place for your winged were-tiger, and maybe it's not at that game, at that time.
Yeah. Oh, I can think of other situations where that would be most welcome. Very welcome.
Absolutely.
Christmases, Thanksgivings, you know, Christmas, everything, but yeah.
Yeah.
I feel you. Mm-hmm. So I think, you know, there are lots of people who have drawn similarities between LARP and improv, or, you know, role-playing in general and improv. And I think most people would, you know, hear about what you do and what you're writing about and be like, yeah, that makes sense. But I'm very curious as to what are some meaningful differences that you see between role-playing and improv performance?
The audience. Who are you doing it for?
Tell me about what that has an impact on. In what way?
If I'm on stage, I am mindful of how the audience is reacting. Especially if I'm doing comedy, I'm listening a little bit. I can't help but listen. Am I getting a laugh? Is the audience engaged in this? You know, are they falling asleep? Audience energy can be very fickle, and sometimes you can have a great show and sometimes you can have a disastrous show. It doesn't have to do with size. It just has to do with the audience energy. And you're performing for them. You know, when I'm gaming, I'm performing for the people at the table, and we're just performing for each other. And so I think there's so much less pressure because you're all invested in it together, as opposed to some people sitting in the dark that you can't see that are watching and judging you.
Yeah, kind of terrifying when you say it like that.
It is a little. It's good that you can't see them. But sometimes you can hear them, or hear the lack of laughter is also very loud.
Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, to what extent do you have to, like, are there ways in which you have to ignore that energy or not think about it? Or is it like, is it an unavoidable presence? Is it something you need to incorporate?
You know, I don't think... I personally don't feel like paying attention to it helps you, because it takes you out of what you're doing. And it can be dangerous if you get a laugh and then start just playing to the laugh as opposed to playing to your partner.
Tell me more about that. That's an interesting thread.
Well, if you're in a scene with someone, you know, you want to be engaged. You're telling a story. You're unfolding it together. Without actually being able to necessarily talk about what you're saying, you're discovering these facts. You're trying to talk in character while establishing backstory with each other or communicating other plot. And if your attention turns away from that to like, oh, I said that funny thing and people laughed, I should jump on that again. You know, I should try to make the audience laugh again. Now you're not paying attention to what this other person is still trying to do with you.
Right. So you're kind of putting that personal need over what the scene needs or what your troupe needs or something.
Yeah. Yeah. For me, I don't always know what the audience is going to laugh at or why.
Yeah.
You know, that's how I feel about Twitter. Yeah. They have a very different perspective of what's happening. So trying to figure that out for me is very elusive. And again, I do a variety of different types of tones of improv. The long form that I do with my troupe Chick Flick is kind of silly, but also it's normally very much rooted in the mundane and about relationships and about how relationships change over time. And we often tell kind of poignant stories about people and maybe their family and their friends. And it still manages to get laughs, but I don't know how. Like, I don't know what people are laughing at so much. I think part of it is, you know, we might be, again, taking something very trivial, very seriously, or just the timing of our delivery. But it's... I've had some practices where, you know, they were very emotional scenes and very sad scenes. And we've had some, you know, scenes in our shows that, you know, for a moment were very serious and sad. And I've seen other shows with other troupes that were really lots of feels, mm-hmm. you know, lots of tears from the audience because that was, you know, what they were going for. They were going for a very dramatic, improvised story.
Right. Where do you think this idea comes from that associates improv with comedy so strongly?
I think that's just what we've seen the most of. Mm-hmm. When most people hear improv, they think about Whose Line Is It Anyway?
Right.
Which is what I grew up on. And that's what I knew of improv. And that's short form comedy. And to make it even harder, though, that's short form comedy recorded on TV. So there could be multiple takes. Uh-huh. It could be slightly more pre-planned. Like, who knows? Someone's going to call me up now and be like, ah, it's all real. How dare you besmirch Whose Line? I think a lot of it just comes from that and what's been the most popular and familiar. And it often is very funny. And you know, theater sports, which is kind of more competitive short form, is a lot of comedy. And a lot of improv can also be kind of blue comedy as well. The Bay Area here in California does more kind of indie-esque, like the indie game version of improv. We do lots of long form with a fair amount of feelings. There's still a lot of comedy, but I see more like experimental long form out here. Of course, it's not like I've traveled the world and seen all the improv there is, so. But there is a lot of that here.
If there's a lot more comedy, do you think it's easier to play for or easier to tend towards?
I don't know. I think it's more fun, maybe. I don't know. That's not true. I've had a ton of fun. I had a ton of fun playing, you know, LARPing where I was crying and I was like, this is the best thing ever. So that's not true. I take that back. I don't know.
It's the great mystery of improv. I love this. I'm trying to think about why improv comedy seems to be more popular and whether it's because it's easier to do or is it just something that's easier to get drawn towards?
I don't think it's easier to do at all.
All the improv comedians are thanking you right now and being like, yes,
yeah,
very much.
It is difficult. You know, just as stand-up is extremely difficult, which is a completely different thing, but you know, it's something that maybe looks effortless and looks very easy, but it is difficult. And to do comedy, to do any type of I think improvised storytelling that is enjoyable for the audience, you really need to be listening to what your partner is saying and building off of that. Reincorporation always gets a laugh. Again, patterns are funny, so if you can remember something and bring it back, if you can find the game a behavior or a line or something that then you can keep repeating in different ways. That's very funny. So trying to find patterns and then playing off of those is always great. But you need to be paying attention and have, you know, maybe have a little bit of an instinct of what's important, you know, what's worth exploring more in this scene. But I mean, but as to why improv comedy is more popular, I think people just like laughing more when they go out for fun.
That is so logical.
I mean, I don't know. It's so philosophical, but I appreciate a good fun humorous set over a more serious one, because I'm not always in the mood. I'm out with my friends, you know, I'm having a good time, maybe I've had a drink, I'm not necessarily in the mood to feel bummed out. However, you can get laughs by making them hurt a little, which is another kind of improv word of wisdom that I heard, is that the best laugh should hurt a little, which is this kind of explosive release of tension. So if you have a very sad scene, at some point that tension has to be released through laughter. So there'll be some line, some moment of levity, and it is an opportunity for everybody to exhale.
So this is why people make jokes during horror games.
Yeah, because you need to release your tension somehow. So,
and yet at the same time, if you want to keep playing the actual game, you got to bring it back, or it's just, you know, silly gonzo. Dang, there's even more connections between improv and gaming than I thought. Even more than was in the book. It just keeps going.
I know, it just keeps going. I think the thing that I try to do in my workshops and so the things I've carried over into the book is just kind of really focus on skill practice in how to tell a story together, how to listen, how to manage plot versus setting, how to direct scenes. You know, all of those are very practical skills. And for me, like, applied improvisation is something that I'm super excited and interested in, is how can we take... how can we practice life skills through fun theater games? You can.
Yeah.
It's
yeah,
a thing.
Tell me more about that.
Yeah, I mean, corporate improv is a huge thing. Doing big improv, like team building exercises and improv workshops for public speaking, for any type of kind of getting over stage fright. And the whole... you know, the whole kind of yes and, I roll my eyes a little bit at that because I have other feelings to unpack about it.
Asterisk.
But the idea of yeah, the idea of rolling with things and being adaptable and being fluid and not pre-planning is such a vital life skill, and it is a muscle that you need to keep stretching. So I keep doing improv. I keep taking classes. It's not something that, you know, once you've got it, you're like, and that's fixed.
Done.
Yeah. So I really hope that this is going to be a fun way for gamers to practice and keep practicing, is by having something accessible like this. Because like I said, improv classes are expensive. Mm-hmm. I know, because I pay for them sometimes. And conventions are expensive. I know, because mm-hmm. I have to pay for those too when I go to them. And those are hobbies that I love, but they also are where all of my money yeah. goes. And so I'm really excited about this book, particularly because it's $20. And then you have it forever.
Yeah.
And that's it. And then you have access to this forever. And I'm hoping it's, you know, something that people can pick up and play and have fun with in little bits and pieces. They don't have to do, you know, an intensive 3-hour workshop out of it like I do. You can just play a couple games here and there for fun with your friends.
Yeah.
And it just makes it more accessible, because, you know, it's so much fun to talk about improv and gaming and read about improv and gaming. But, you know, like you said at the beginning, I'm a kinesthetic learner, and I believe in experiential learning And I wanted people to do it, to actually feel what it is that we're talking about, because improv is a live thing.
Yeah, completely. And it's something that's like in your body, right? Mm-hmm. It's somatic knowledge, not like just kind of intellectual absorption.
Yeah. And I feel like if we just talk about yes and, that doesn't mean as much as actually doing something that illustrates that idea.
Yeah. Okay, so why does yes and make you cringe? I know why it makes me cringe, but I'm way more interested in hearing from you.
I think the first thing that happens in a level one class, and it happened to me, it happens to everybody, it's okay, is you lose your filter, because part of it is being creative and, you know, just kind of saying what comes to mind. But if you lose your filter too much, you're not paying attention to people's boundaries. And yes and can be misinterpreted as a blank check. And it's not a blank check. It there's so much trust and expectation of trust behind it. Of, I trust that you're not going to give me a weird, gross offer that I don't want to work with. I'm excited and enthusiastic for all the cool stuff that you have to offer instead. So some people talk more about maybe consider yes. You know, the yes and is the idea of being, you know, enthusiastically listening, willing to incorporate other people's ideas, but it's not a rule that can be manipulated to make people feel uncomfortable. And it often is, you know, it often is. And I remember in my, you know, level one classes getting some weird offers that made me deeply uncomfortable. And I didn't know. I was like, am I not cool if I don't want to play with this? You know, am I breaking improv by saying no here? And so there's a lot, you know, there's a lot of talk and theory about how do you manage a bad actor when you're on stage with them? And I mean bad actor like a person doing bad actions.
Yeah.
Not that they're a poor actor. But so there's, you know, there, and there's, I've been to classes on that about how do you manage somebody who's gone a little too gonzo, and you're on stage. You know, you don't have the cut and break. You don't have an X card. You don't have all of these wonderful safety tools that we use to calibrate the content that we want in a way that's really fun and seamless without feeling like we're breaking character. And so you have to have so much more trust and an ability to, you know the people that you're playing with. And that's why you have troops. You have people who work with each other a ton, and you just get to know each other, and you know where you can push each other. You know the types of characters that people are going to enjoy playing. It can be a little scary sometimes to go to a jam. A jam is kind of like the open mic night of improv. Where you, and different people run it differently, but basically a bunch of improvisers show up at a theater, and groups of perhaps strangers or perhaps a couple of friends or people who don't know each other, kind of know each other, will get up on stage and maybe do a scene for a couple of minutes. Maybe they'll do like a short form exercise. It's up to the, you know, the host to sort it out. But you're getting up on stage with people that you haven't worked with maybe. And that can be a little risky because you don't know what they're going to say. And it is still very, I think improv, you know, has, like most of the world, it has kind of a white dude problem. So there's a lot to unpack there about about bias in improv. I've been cast many times. You know, it's hard.
You've been cast?
Oh, I've been cast as, so I was in a troupe starting out that was pretty equally weighted. Amongst the genders. At one point, I think a lot of people were just out sick. And so I was really the only woman there. And I suddenly, in every scene, was either the girlfriend or the mistress or just the straight up prostitute or the nagging wife. Suddenly I was being assigned all of these just squicky roles by my friends, by like guys that I'd been going to class with for a while. I was just like, what is going on here? And you can, you know, you can work yourself to try to be more savvy and know how to spin those things around, and you can make them work for you. And you know, or you can stop playing with those people, you know, or you can, you know, or you can talk to them later and say, hey, I actually don't enjoy being those characters all the time. Don't do that. And then they know that's not the type of, you know, that's the expectation that you're setting. You're like, I don't want to do those types of scenes.
And that's a perfectly reasonable request, right? This comes back to that sort of like, you know, not having pressure to accept everything just because it's an offer that's put out there. Yeah, I'm really glad that that's something that you clarify in the book, that difference between like yesing everything, you know, that, yeah, I'm not articulating it well. You do. I'm glad you did.
Oh, thank you. it's an important thing to remember in any game. And I, you know, and we talk about it in different ways in games about, you know, don't go too gonzo, and is also just like, don't take advantage of yes and by just kind of running off completely off the rails with your ideas, because you lose focus. And also, you know, then you're not necessarily having fun with people. You know, if you're having fun making somebody else uncomfortable, that's only fun for one person.
It's not the best fun. I'm not super into that fun.
No. No.
And there's so much more fun to be had if we can all have fun.
Yeah, and I mean, if you've got that one person in your gamer group who just always wants to destroy the party and be difficult and you know, isn't on the same page with everybody else, and they're having fun at your expense, and you know, eventually they're not going to get invited back, and that's a shame because I'm sure that they're a nice person and they thought they were having fun.
Yeah, it's nice to be able to have conversations about stuff like that, you know, regardless of how you're interacting with someone, right?
I try to assume best intentions from people, but still,
it's good to start there. I wanted to ask you, during this interview, do you feel like you're on?
Yeah, I think a bit. I certainly am aware that this is going to be listened to, and how often I say which I'm sure is a lot. And I definitely have a lot of, I don't know, maybe I don't actually want this part to go on it. Maybe I do. I have a lot of fear of criticism when this book comes out, of being attacked kind of on both sides, because both hobbies that I'm in, I have people that are very vocal about how they feel about it. And I'm concerned about people getting upset about saying, oh, you've only been doing improv for this long. You didn't go to Chicago, so you're not actually learning real improv. So what do you know about it? And then, you know, from the other side of being, you know, you're just some silly story gamer, which I feel is, you know, again, I started playing AD&D, so I do know. But... and I still play Pathfinder and I love it, but I am worried about the criticism of trying, being accused of not being an expert, when I'm really not trying to be an expert. I'm just trying to share what I've learned and had a lot of fun doing.
And so, you know, feeling that fear, how do you and why do you do something like this anyway? Make a book like this?
People kept asking me to. I used to write. I know. I used to. So I used to teach English as a second language. And I would write extremely detailed lesson plans for myself, because that's just the type of person that I am. And so when I was teaching improv, I would write extremely detailed lesson plans. And especially when first starting out, I would script things for myself. I'd be very detailed, make lots of notes. So I had, you know, this like sheaf of paper that I'm referring to as I'm teaching, and people would ask me for my notes, and I'd get all like Gollum-y about it and be like, no, don't look. And also like, no, these don't make any sense to you. They're written to me by me, and they're written, you know, from the perspective of how to teach, how to facilitate it, not necessarily how to do it. And, but I had enough people ask, and I thought, you know, maybe I should just try to write all this up in a way that actually makes sense. And the first draft that I gave to my editor was a mess. I had to rewrite the whole thing. I thought, oh, I have all of these lesson plans. Like, I can just add a little bit more in the introductions and talk a little bit more about the overlap and then plop in these instructions and done. But they were written for the completely wrong audience. So I had to go through and rewrite everything completely differently to try to make it a guide that people could pick up and play themselves. Because originally I had thought I would write it to addressing it to like a facilitator who could then go run whole workshops. And then thought, well, that's just not going to happen. People aren't going to do that. But people can play, you know, a game for 5-10 minutes with their friends a lot more easily. And so I should write for that so that people actually read the book more.
People actually read it, yeah.
That's, so people actually want to use it. Yeah, I just want people to try some fun theater games and then apply those skills more in their gaming and hopefully, you know, just have fun.
I am so curious about what it was like for you to be working with an editor and with a proofreader and to be handing off that particular set of reins.
It was great. Honestly, it was nice to not have to worry about that. I didn't argue with my editor at all. My editor was Josh Earsley, and he's great. I know him through, he works with other Evil Hat projects, and so I kind of specifically said, like, if you're available, I would love for you to be my editor, because I liked his style of communicating and giving feedback. And so I really did not argue with him on, like, any notes, you know. Because I knew that from the author perspective, I couldn't see it the same way that he was looking at it. And, you know, just from that different perspective makes a huge difference. So I certainly, you know, revised a ton myself, but I really did try to let him be the authority on what changes needed to be made.
That's nice that it was liberating rather than terrifying. To let someone else be doing that.
I was certainly scared of somebody else reading my book, and I'm going to be scared when it's available to purchase. But he was great, and you know, he gave some really good feedback at the very beginning. And again, I took 3 months and kind of rewrote the whole thing and gave it back to him. And he was like, "Oh wow, this is like a whole new book." I was like, "Yeah, it is," because I literally rewrote every word. But I it's still, you know, I had been kind of writing that book for some time with all of the lesson planning that I had been making. So I had a fairly strong idea of how I wanted it structured. And I love that we were able to make every exercise is like a 2-page spread, which just makes me so happy in some like weird symmetrical mathematical way that every page you open up and that's all you see. You just see that one exercise contained. It's great.
all the layout artists who listen are just like nodding as though to a beautiful song.
There's no page flipping.
Was there anything else about this process that was like really fun for you or kind of new?
What was something that was super fun was doing the art references. So, one, the artist is amazing, and she did such an amazing job. And
who is the artist that you have on there?
Oh, her name is Megan Penley, and she's great, and she's also worked with Evil Hat before. And I looked through her portfolio online and saw something and was just like, I want that style. That's perfect. I want that, but for my book. And so she has these amazing line drawings. They're so expressive because improv is really hard to photograph. It's a lot of people standing, maybe with their arms out, and maybe you get some really fun expressions. You can catch people in really fun mid-physical movement, but a lot of it is just maybe not, maybe you don't get that physicality, but the scene happening is amazing, but, you know, the photo of it is not. So I knew that we needed something that was very dramatic, a lot of people in very dynamic poses, lots of really expressive facial features. And And so I loved the sample of her art that had these kind of cartoony characters. I thought, this is great. This is just what I want. And I also knew specifically the reason that we wanted art was not just for flavor, but to show how some of these things are supposed to look, because some of the exercises are physical. They require a hand gesture or require you to do some physical movements. And I wasn't always sure that I could really explain that in text. So I wanted a visual to help people understand this is what it's supposed to look like. You know, there's an exercise in there called the Golden Goose, which takes five people and they all strike a very specific pose as part of the exercise. And so I wanted people to kind of see it should look something like this. And so in order to get those for the art requests, I had a bunch of friends over and I made them do all of these poses and take photos with my phone. And, you know, we didn't really play the games. I kind of set up a little bit of what I wanted them to do. And maybe we would kind of fake play a game for a couple seconds and I would run and take pictures. And then I'd ask them to freeze and I'd take pictures from different angles. And then we sent all those with descriptions to the artist. And so the really fun thing is looking at the art now and seeing, recognizing the poses, because the characters don't look anything like my friends who were over. But I can still see a little bit of them sometimes in an expression, or I just know when I look at it, I was like, oh, I know that we, you know, staged that pretty much the same way that she drew it.
That sounds really, really fun.
It is super fun.
Well, it sounds like it's been an exciting experience. And it's been the culmination of a lot of work you've been doing for like a long time, which is pretty awesome.
Yeah, because I started teaching this like 6 years ago. Yeah, that's wild.
Moment of reflection.
Wait, eight. Someone's telling me 8 years ago. It's not 8 years.
Is that Sean Nittner back there?
Yes.
Previous backstory guest, Sean Nittner, is joining us on the program.
Holding up eight fingers. Eight? But we haven't been together for 8 years. Okay, we'll have to do some timelining. It's been between 6 to 8 years.
Between 6 and 8 years. Who can really tell? Who knows which timeline we're in anyway?
I don't know. I'd have to go dig up my Gen Con badge because I'm sure I saved it of the first year I went to Gen Con, and then I'd know.
Wait, I got something. Whose timeline is it anyway? Is that good?
That is really good.
Thank you.
Does that already exist? Can we Google it? Is that a thing already?
We should. Let's Google it now. And
because that would be...
if it's not, we have the starting of a... Fuck. It's a podcast.
Oh, it's a podcast. It's a podcast.
Okay, well, nice. Maybe that's good.
Aw. No, we weren't the first to think of it. Oh, well.
But that's good. Now we don't have to do anything.
Exactly.
Okay, well.
It's been done.
On that note, thank you so much, Karen. This was super, super fun. I'm really glad you could join me on the show.
Mm-hmm. Thanks so much.
on today's show, you can always email me, that's backstorypodcast@gmail.com, or you can tweet at me at backstorycast. Backstory is produced by Alex Sisk and hosted on the One Shot Podcast Network. You can go to oneshotpodcast.com to hear more great RPG-related shows, like one of our newest offerings, The Broadswords. The Broadswords is an all-women D&D podcast focused on drama, roleplay, and subverting stereotypes. Join the Broads as they unravel the mysteries of snowy Rashomon, a land ruled by witches and steeped in superstition. Berserkers reign and spirits roam the frozen wastes. Ilaris, Kelia, and Mapri all have their own reasons for journeying north, but they soon find they have something in common. They are pawns in a divine plot. It sounds very exciting, listeners. I hope you give it a shot. Music for Backstory is provided by Uchiko. The track is called Thinking of You, and you can hear more at soundcloud.com/UJICO. You can also find them on Spotify and YouTube and probably other really cool places that I don't even know about. Talk to you later, friends.